I got to open today's show saying thank you. We just hit episode 50. This is episode 50 of the Kevin O'Connor Show. Thank you so much, everybody, for all of your support so far. It's been a great year with Yahoo Sports. Really, really excited what we got coming in the months ahead as well. My draft guide's coming out. We're ramping up our draft coverage. I'm stoked about that. Today on the show, we got Tom Haverstraw, as we do every Friday. And then later on, bringing Gordon Hayward, talking about the NBA draft. So that's all coming up next. Welcome back, Kevin O'Connor Show. Episode 50. Episode 50 already. Thank you, everybody, for the support of the show. We're growing quicker than I ever could have anticipated. Let's bring on Tom Haverstraw to talk about the latest going on around the NBA. Tom, how are you doing today, man?
I'm celebrating your 50th show with some New England coffee here, some Dunkin' right here. So KOC, I'm right there with you. Here in Charlotte, North Carolina, we got some Dunkin' Donuts to celebrate your 50th show. So congratulations. I'm glad to be here.
Appreciate it, Tom. America runs on Dunkin'. I grew up with them on every block around my neighborhood growing up. They're everywhere in Northeast, in Massachusetts, and all of New England, really. Let's talk about the NBA, Tom, starting with the tanking has begun. The tanking has begun. De'Aaron Fox scores 32 points in a Spurs win on Wednesday, and then the Spurs say, no. That's enough. You're getting your pinky surgery. You're sitting down for the year. We got Paul George of the Sixers consulting with doctors on treatment options for groin and knee injuries. Let's start with the Spurs, Tom. It feels like we are entering the point here where some of these teams are saying, okay, time to look ahead to Cooper Flagg and Dylan Harper and hoping for some lottery luck in May.
Yeah, and I feel like the NBA, when they released that press release that they're fining the Utah Jazz $100,000 for sitting Lauri Markkanen without any sort of credible medical information to say that he could not play, he was not physically able to play, I think that was a warning shot to the rest of the league. Was like, we are going to clamp down on the Lauri Markkanens of the world and make sure that everyone's going to be, you know, that the integrity of your medical reports have to be on point. And so De'Aaron Fox getting sat, I think, tells me, you know, the Spurs also have the Atlanta Hawks pick this year, and that's not as valuable as I thought it was, because the Hawks are continuing to hover around 50% or playing 500. And so this is, you know, the Spurs' opportunity to tank their own chances and raise the odds of the ping pong balls working in their favor.
I mean, in some regards, obviously you want Victor Wembanyama to be healthy and hopefully he's able to get back to 100% and never have injuries again moving forward in his career. But in some regards for the Spurs, it's like, this year's a big win. Victor made progress. He took a step forward in his career, even better defensively than he was as a rookie when he was already dominant, making progress offensively as well. And you get De'Aaron Fox, a piece for your future. And guess what? You're also going to have pretty good lottery odds. There's a real chance that, who knows, the Spurs move into that top four. They currently have the ninth best odds. They're a half game back from your Portland Trailblazers. That's probably about as high they would move in terms of lottery odds. Probably eighth best is what you could see the Spurs end up getting. But, you know, I mean, for San Antonio, if they're able to move up, whether it's the big prize in Cooper Flagg or one of those other guys, it positions the Spurs to better able build around Victor in the future. And then for the Philadelphia 76ers, Embiid already out for the remainder of the season. The Sixers currently have the sixth best lottery odds, and their pick is top six protected. Otherwise, it goes to Oklahoma City. For them, they're a half game back from the Nets, who have the fifth best odds, which would give them a slightly better chance of moving up, a 42.1% chance of keeping their pick versus 37.2% currently in that sixth slot. Shutting down George would make sense for them because this is a lost year, no point in trying to win these games down the stretch. It is a complete failure, you know, forget about it season, and then figure things out this offseason. So whether it's trading George, whether it's trading, you know, Joel Embiid, or whether it's trading the pick to build around those guys, that's what would best position the Sixers to end up moving forward in a positive way. Otherwise, Tom, boy, if OKC were to get that pick, this horrible nightmare of a year would continue.
But would we get playoff podcasts back. Playoff P podcasting back when he's got the he's done playing. So I wonder if now the championship is out of his grasp. You know, he said, I want to focus on bringing a championship to Philadelphia. I'm going to shut down the podcast. With him being silent for the rest of the year, I'm wondering if we can turn the mics back on.
I would love that. Paul George, I never anticipated he'd be so good on podcasts. I just didn't see it coming. Did you see it coming, Tom? Did you have any idea he'd be that good on mic?
Okay. But the number one pick on this, better than we thought, podcasting is Jeff Teague. And that's not because it's Wake Forest.
Legends.
Jeff Teague. I did not even know this, that Jeff Teague had this. He's the best storyteller. Forget media. Like, in the NBA period, he is the best storyteller. And I never saw that coming from Teague.
No, I had no idea. I mean, there was a recent thread on X earlier this week where it's like, you know, Jeff Teague's the best storyteller. And then you like scroll through the comments and scroll through the quotes. And it's just like some of the best stories ever. And because it's, sometimes it's not just Teague, it's the friends he brings on. Like Evan Turner was telling this story on there about how like Brad Stevens is in the huddle calling a play and he's writing the initials for the play call. And it's like MS for Marcus Smart, right? JT for Jason Tatum. And then he writes Jet. And Evan's like, who the hell is Jet? it's like, wait, Jeff Teague?
Yeah.
Jeff Teague.
Yo,
Jeff Teague, the veteran, gets demoted to Jet. And Jason Tatum becomes JT.
You know how musicians just put out greatest hits albums just to like juice the stats and get more hits on the same, you know, they're fracking the pool essentially. I feel like that's what Jeff Teague is on Twitter is I will watch his greatest hits reels nonstop. I can't stop. Like I can't stop watching Jeff Teague clips. And I think it was on X where there was like a 9-minute greatest hits reel of Jeff Teague stories. Wow. Yeah. And I watched it like back to back because they're so good.
Yeah, I mean, he's an incredible storyteller. I love Jeff Teague's podcast is top notch. I mean, it's nice when players have good podcasts. Gilbert Arenas obviously goes viral all the time for some crazy takes and whatnot. Jeff Teague goes crazy for the stories. Let's talk a little bit more about tanking here. The Miami Heat, they've lost 14 of their last 20 games. They've lost 5 in a row now. They've fallen all the way to the 9 seed. And if they stay in the 9 slot, that would mean they have to win 2 play-in games in order to move back into the playoffs and get the 8 seed. And, you know, first round against Cleveland, you're probably getting smoked. Tom, are the Heat stealth tanking or do they just stink?
I think they just stink, man. This, you know, Jimmy Butler raises the floor and raises the ceiling of the Warriors, and he lowers the floor and lowers the ceiling for the Miami Heat. I mean, that we talked about on the Big Number this week with Dan Devine, which you can catch every Thursday on Yahoo Sports on YouTube or on wherever you get your podcast. And I talked about how that might be the greatest swing trade at the deadline. If the Warriors win the championship this year, it'll be the best midseason trade. Since what? Clyde Drexler, when they won the championship with Houston. And I can't imagine that Miami feels better today about that trade than they did at any point, where you're looking at this Miami Heat team, and it is proving the fact that without Jimmy Butler, they're a mediocre team. And the same goes for the Warriors, where it's like he is the guy that they were looking for who solves all of their problems. And we were coming up with nicknames for Jimmy Butler. We landed on adult diapers for Jimmy because he solves all your mistakes. And he did kind of soil himself in a game where it looked like he did a few weeks ago. And so Jimmy Butler is not only raising all of the championship odds for the Warriors, and they look so good with him on the floor. But I think it just proves that Miami Heat do not have the talent to compete. And it was mostly, if not all, Jimmy Butler and playoff Jimmy raising them to that NBA Finals trip twice in his tenure. And this Miami Heat team, they're 2-6 in clutch situations with the worst plus minus in clutch situations since the All-Star break. And so I'm not saying they're like purposely tanking and throwing these games, but I would not blame you if you thought that watching them in close and late situations this year.
It's a bummer, man. I mean, if you're a Miami Heat fan, Bam Adebayo this year has not been taking the leap in the way that you might have anticipated. Tyler Hero starts the year absolutely incredibly. I mean, he's an all-star, and he looks like he's taking a leap. He's talking about how he wanted to model his shot selection after Stephen Curry and everything, and he looked awesome. And then ever since really he got named an all-star in late January, it's been really up and down, very inconsistent game to game for him. And so, you know, Jaime Jaquez in his second year has not quite been the same guy he was as a rookie. So, you know, Kalel Ware is a positive. There's still some bright spots for that team, but ultimately it feels like the Heat are in a position where they are rightfully, you know, it's a good thing right now that you're losing games because you want those higher draft lottery odds, whether it's to move up at four or at least have a late lottery pick. But, you know, it's a major bummer for Heat fans this year. It is a major bummer in every way. And understandably so, whether tanking or whether they just stink, these teams are tanking for a reason, Tom. I mean, Cooper Flagg, he gets hurt on Thursday, suffers a sprained ankle. Hopefully he's not out for a long period of time. I talk about that with Gordon Hayward later in the podcast. We talk about Flagg and who some of the guys on Duke are that could step up and help that team win or also, you know, improve their draft stock and a prospect, Con Knipl being top of that list. But it is weird, mm-hmm. you know, this month for the teams that have lottery hopes. Dylan Harper for Rutgers, Ace Bailey for Rutgers as well. You know, maybe even Trey Johnson for Texas. It's very possible three of the top five picks aren't going to be playing in March Madness. If Cooper's missing time, he'll be inactive. It's very possible four of the top five picks might not be playing in March. Like, that's a major bummer for college basketball for us. Also, you know, us as NBA draft snobs.
Yeah. Well, also, it's a race to the bottom. So as we see De'Aaron Fox getting shut down and Lauri Markkanen missing games, and we see potentially Bam Adebayo or someone else who's going to suffer some sort of Achilles tendonitis and have to sit out games, it's going to have a snowball effect, Kev. Like, you're going to see other teams look at their roster and say, we've got to race these other people who are sitting their guys. Paul George out, Embiid's out, Tyrese Maxey and out indefinitely. We don't know when he's coming back. And so I think you're going to see more of this as we get down to the stretch, and it's going to impact the other side of the standings, which is the play-in tournament. A lot of teams are fighting for that sixth spot, making sure, like Minnesota, the Clippers, the Warriors, it is basically a playoff push right now for those three teams in the Western Conference. And if they're playing the Spurs or they're playing Utah, this is going to dramatically impact the playoff race and therefore playoff the championship, you know, contention. So this is a huge story, and I'm not surprised that the NBA is trying to clamp down on this, but if you're opting for surgery or considering surgery, I mean, you can't really do anything about that. The league has no power to fine the San Antonio Spurs when a guy is going to opt for surgery. It's the cases where a guy has a knee soreness or Achilles tendonitis or groin soreness that it is going to be, you know, incumbent on the teams to provide that hard record of this is what our doctor's showing us, because it is going to be a tank fest down the stretch for a lot of these teams.
One team that's not tanking is your Portland Trail Blazers. I say that even though they lost five games in a row, but they are competing their asses off in those games, dude. That game against the Knicks on Wednesday that went to overtime, Mikal Bridges game winner. What a game, dude. Like, Tom, like, you must have been flipping out watching that game. Like, it was just so fun. It was one of the best regular season games of the year, and the Blazers were fighting their asses off in it.
Yeah, Kevin Calabro in my ear, he's like, what is the record for lead changes? And I'm like, you know what? I got to look this up. We were at like 37 lead changes in the fourth quarter, and I was sitting there being like, that's got to be an NBA record. So I go and I look this up, and accordingly, the record was set in 2023 with a Mikal Bridges game winner when he was with the Brooklyn Nets over the Atlanta Hawks. And I was like, oh, wow, Mikal Bridges is playing in this game. And then sure enough, Mikal Bridges has a game winner in overtime, and it was the same exact score as the record for lead changes, 43 lead changes in 2023 in that game, and 42 for this Blazers game. Would have been the record had it not been for that Mikal game winner back in 2023. Kev, this game was so exciting, so awesome to watch. The Denny Avdija and one to give them the lead down the stretch. The referees were very questionable when they had an inadvertent whistle that gave the New York Knicks the ball, a sideline out of bounds play there late in the game. It was a very bizarre game, crazy game. But I promise you, Kev, we are this is proof that we are living in some sort of simulation.
Keep your third eye open, Kev.
That's right. Keep your third eye open. How else can you explain that we had a Mikal Bridges game-winning, buzzer-beating three-pointer to end the game with the score 114-113 with 40-plus lead changes? What else can you do to explain that?
I think it does serve as proof for simulation theory.
Yeah. Do you remember, I think JJ Redick, did he present that in the Sixers? I think he presented that theory or something, some version of that with the Sixers. Kevin Arnovitz reported that like the Sixers a few years ago in the locker room, they would make presentations about something about non-basketball and present it to the team. And I want to say that JJ Redick proposed the simulation theory to the rest of the 76ers. And I want the whole deck. Like, we talk about the greatest hits with Jeff Teague on his podcast. I want the whole deck of Philadelphia 76ers making presentations to their team about something non-basketball related. The science project for all the players. I want that.
That does sound like something JJ would do. It wouldn't surprise me one bit. Very, very deep, thoughtful guy. I want to ask you about Scoot, because ever since his big breakout came 2 months ago, January 14th, he had 39 points. He's been averaging 15.3 points on 41.9% from three, 5.2 assists to only 2.6 turnovers. And then he had 30 points on Wednesday in that game against the Knicks. What's different about Scoot right now, what he's been doing these last 2 months versus early in the season, then also versus last year when he looked kind of busty? He just did. But at this point, he looks like a real point guard.
He does. And it's the number one, it's the decision making. A lot better decisions. He's not trying to make the flashy play every single time down the floor. And I think being a 19-year-old in the NBA with that kind of hype, I think he wanted to prove, you know, just like when you're a kid and you're playing with your older brother and their friends, that you can play and you do the risky play, the flashy play to wow them rather than the smart play. And this year, he's doing a lot more of the smart play, and you're seeing a lot of the efficiency numbers improve. But in particular, the second thing is not just the decision making, it's the 3-point shooting. In the first season with the Blazers last year, it was rough in the beginning, and the teams decided to just go Rajon Rondo on him and decide to play back on him and give him the Tony Allen Rajon Rondo treatment and let him shoot. In the 2023 calendar year, he was shooting 28% from three. In the 2024 calendar year, shooting 33% from three. And in the 2025 calendar year, he's shooting 40% from downtown. And that right there is probably going to improve his overall game the most, is when the defender has to go over the screen and then he can attack the rim. And he was getting at the rim at will against the New York Knicks. And Deuce McBride could not stay in front of him. And Scoot Henderson is strong enough, and he's got the right athleticism around the rim to take advantage. So that 3-point shot is improving. His decision-making is improving. And his craftiness around the rim is something that a lot of people around the league have been surprised at, is that the improvement from last year to this year, he's got a layup package that is really impressive. And I think you're going to see him continue to improve once teams decide, we can't guard him like Rondo or Tony Allen anymore. We have to go over the screen, and that's just going to open up so much more for Scoot.
I mean, ultimately, like, I think Scoot clearly self-assessed the flaws from last year and went hard at work, because with Scoot, he was such, at the high school level and even G League when he was playing for the Ignite, he's usually the best athlete on the floor. And then he gets on an NBA floor and it's like, oh, wait a minute, I'm not able to just get to the rim and explode the way I have in the past. He added more of a layup package to improve his craft at the rim. The shooting range has expanded, as you said, Tom, and that's been key to everything for him. So for Scoot, he's the strange thing with him is he's always been like a good touch guy. He's always had good touch on those little floater range shots. He's always been an 80-ish percent guy from the free throw line. It's just the 3-point shot had never really manifested. But currently, he's feeling like one of those many examples of guys that if you bet on touch near the rim, if you bet on touch from the free throw line, eventually for a lot of those guys, it ends up translating from three-point range. And I really think that's what we're seeing right now from Scoot. And it also shows like the importance of patience with some of these young guards. Like you can't overvalue what they do their rookie years. Oftentimes at that position, as deep as the position is in the NBA, as big as the position is in the NBA, and just how athletic those players are, it's tough for point guards to come in right away and make a big impact.
Yeah, and he was a teenager. Like we have to harp on the fact that it's tough. They don't have the number, their age on the back of their jersey. It's hard to remind ourselves that that dude is oftentimes a decade younger than the guy he's going against. And I'm reminded of De'Aaron Fox. If you look at his first couple years in the league, it was a lot of the same story, is that it took a while for him to figure out the pace of the league, get his jump shot in order. And I see a lot of the same similarities with Scoot Henderson, as we saw with De'Aaron Fox, another athletic, up-tempo point guard that needed some time to figure it out. And then he's an all-star.
Last thing I want to talk about from that Blazers-Knicks game is Mikal Bridges before the game. Before he hit that game winner, he talked openly, which surprised me, to the media, that he basically said to Tom Thibodeau, hey, we don't need to play as much as that we are. He said, sometimes it's not fun on the body. He talked to Tibbs a little bit about knowing that we've got a good enough team where our bench guys can come in and we don't need to play all 48. And then he said, we've got a lot of good guys on this team that can take minutes away, which helps the defense, helps the offense, helps tired bodies being out there and giving up all these points. It just helps keeping fresh bodies out there. And then they go to overtime and he hits the game winner. But I, to Bridges' point, I think he's right here. You have Hart and Bridges at 1 and 2 in the NBA in minutes per game. OG Anunoby at number 6. Brunson and Cat are also both in the top 25. So all five of their starters are in the top 25 for minutes. It's the only team you can say that about in the NBA. 3 of their starters are in the top 6, 2 in the top 2. I'd argue, and I posted this on X, that their bench has some quality options. Deuce McBride currently having to start with Jalen Brunson out, but you got like earlier this year, you had Jericho Sims, who was not playing a lot. He's playing well right now with more minutes for the Bucks. You still have Precious Achiuwa, who's playing very well off the bench, but I don't think playing enough. Mitchell Robinson has been excellent ever since he came back on February 28th, as has the Knicks defense. Maybe uptick his minutes a little bit as the season goes on. Play him more in some two big lineups with Cat. It's not like the Knicks don't have options. Landry Shamet is not a 16-game player, but he's an 82-game player who can help you with some regular season minutes and spacing. I'd like to see Tibbs do that to close the year and keep his bodies fresh for the playoffs and avoid a repeat of last year.
By the way, Mikal Bridges is the only guy on that roster, I'm pretty sure, who's been to the NBA Finals or close to it. You know, when you look at a guy that you want to listen to when he talks about what it takes to win and go far in the postseason, I would listen to Mikal Bridges. Some people might say, hey, your star player shouldn't be complaining about too many minutes. And I would say, well, I mean, we've seen Tom Thibodeau teams do very well in the regular season and then peter out in the postseason. And Mikal Bridges going to the NBA Finals with the Phoenix Suns, I think we should listen to him. And by the way, did you hear what Tom Thibodeau said after the game when asked about that? He said, we never had a conversation. Mikal Bridges said he asked Tom Thibodeau. The report was that he asked Tom Thibodeau to come back on the minutes a little bit and play the bench a little bit more. And Tom Thibodeau denied that they even had a conversation. Which, do you think Mikal Bridges was like, hey, Tibbs, hey, man, kind of feel like we should play our bench a little bit more? Do you? And then Tibbs was just like, hey, do you guys hear something? Do you guys hear anything? Do you think he straight up ignored Mikal Bridges? Because that's the only way I can see that, like, the report is accurate, that Mikal Bridges asked him, and then Tibbs was like, we did not have a conversation.
It's like, oh, sorry, I had no service. The text didn't come in. I don't see it on my screen. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I was in airplane mode. My bad. What were you saying? But yeah, and then he had to play 41 minutes against the Blazers and have to guard, Shaden Sharp. And it was, you know what? It was a great thing to see because I wrote about this at TomTheFinder.com, is that Mikal Bridges, for a guy who got 5 first round picks and a swap, you know, traded for him last offseason, he has not had a breakout year for the Knicks. It's been very up and down. And by estimated plus minus, he is not a top 150 player in terms of the performance this season. And so with Jalen Brunson being out, he stepped up in a big way, hitting that last second shot, getting into the mid range and being a shot creator that we got to see in Brooklyn the last couple of years. And so for me, Mikal busting out of, you know, this, I wouldn't say a season long slump, but showing that he can be a number two or a number three attacker offensively and not just standing in the corner, that is a good thing to see if you're the New York Knicks. And I keep going back to that playoff run with the Miami Heat when I was covering the team, when Chris Bosh was sidelined with that abdominal strain. Eric Spoelstra said, like, sometimes adversity is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to kind of see some things that we didn't get an opportunity to see because, you know, Chris Bosh is great. We're not going to bench Chris Bosh and see what Shane Battier can do at the four. But when Chris Bosh was out, that's what kind of unlocked the spacing, floor spacing five, Bosh at the five, with Shane Battier at the four against the Indiana Pacers. And that kind of unlocks their championship ceiling is when Chris Bosh got hurt, that's when they decided to get a little bit more unconventional and things started to unlock. And I think we might see that with the Knicks. And I got to say, I agree with Mikal Bridges. If you take down our minutes a little bit, maybe we can see more in the most Spurs way. Is like, we don't want to play these guys 40 minutes because we want our bench, in case something happens or someone gets injured, we want them to get those minutes and feel comfortable playing it as a starter. And I think that's what Mikal Bridges, the spirit of what he's saying, is our bench is good enough and let's see more of these guys because we're going to depend on them in big moments in the playoffs.
That's spot on, Tom. And the Heat parallel, I 100% agree with as well, because with Jalen Brunson, it works with him. The Knicks have a dominant offense. He is unbelievable. Jalen Brunson is an unbelievable player. But sometimes you got to see what else you got. And Mikal Bridges getting this higher usage without him, more minutes for Deuce McBride, all of that could end up being very valuable for the Knicks come playoff time. A quick reminder to listeners and viewers, my NBA draft guide is launching with Yahoo Sports in less than 2 weeks. We're launching it before the Sweet 16. I am very, very excited about that. We'll be ramping up the draft coverage on this podcast as well, including today with my conversation on Gordon Hayward. You can find that in a separate video on YouTube if you're watching us there. And it'll also be later on this podcast where we talk about Cooper Flagg's injury, some of the guys who could step up, like Tom said, with the Heat, who could step up for Duke without Cooper Flagg. We talk about that later with Gordon Hayward, and we'll be right back. All right, Tom, Patrick Dumont said something silly again. He said something very silly. It feels like the Mavericks fans, like anytime you might forget about it, you wake up some morning and like something else is on your mind for the first time in a month. There's something else that just gets your attention and makes you remember that trade. And Dumont did that on Thursday. He said, after the trade deadline last year, we actually had the best record in basketball, which was a big accomplishment. And we got to the championship games. And we didn't win, so we had to decide, how do we get better? And he says, so we looked at our trajectory during the season and realized that we did not get better, but the teams that we competed against did get better. So this was a decision about the future. If you look at our roster today and who we have, we feel like we position ourselves to be incredibly competitive against the best teams in the NBA. Tom, I thought Nico Harrison said the trade was about the next 2, 3, 4 years and maximizing their championship window, not about the future. So what's going on here? What's going on?
First of all, championship games? What? Yeah.
What?
Like big red flag. Big red big flag red calling flag. It the championship
This is like when he talked about players with high work ethic and he didn't mention Dirk, but he did mention Shaquille O'Neal.
Maybe stop talking about basketball. Maybe.
Yes, just stop.
Maybe. I'm surprised you didn't call it, hey, we played good with that sports ball, you know, with the round orange thing, throwing it in the orange circle. Like, That was championship games. Just was like, stop, just stop talking. And he kept going and he kept going and talking about how we built this team for the future. We made the trade for the future. When you traded away a 25-year-old for a 32-year-old, what are you talking about? What are you? And it's contradicting, like you said, to what Nico Harrison is talking about. The talking points continue to change. And usually, you know what that means? Is you're lying. There's something that you're not telling us. There's the reason why the pretext of the trade continues to change. First, it was defense. Then it's winning now. And then it's about work ethic and all this. The word that stood out to me, he said it a few times in that interview. There was a 9-minute clip that was shared. That it was very wide ranging about this Mavs trade and the Mavs situation. There was a couple references to character. The word character, that they want high character guys, and that Dirk Nowitzki is a high character guy, and what we're about as an organization is a high character guy. Keep saying this. What is he referring to? Is he referring to like hookah and drinking beers after a game? Or is there something else that Patrick Dumont can't say publicly, but he has to reference this consistently? Because none of the other explanations make any sense. None of them do. And it's just stop talking. Like, stop. 9 minutes of explaining the Luka trade that continues to dig himself further and further into a hole. First, it's long-term. Then it's a short-term thing. And he's now saying, like, Dirk Nowitzki, my bad. I know you went to go to the Lakers game to support Luka Doncic, but you're one of us still. There's much more that we can learn from his commitment to the city of Dallas and his work ethic. I feel like he's doing a makeup call here for what you referenced earlier.
I think that's all it is. But honestly, what I really just think it is deep down inside, he knows they screwed up. I think he knows they screwed up. And this is just coming up with excuses, trying to rationalize what you did. And, you know, I just feel bad. I feel bad for Mavericks fans more than anything else. I just feel bad for Dallas Mavericks fans. I'm very sad for them. They have such a passionate fan base. I've been there for playoff games. I've been to a lot of different arenas for playoff games. Mavericks fans are some of the loudest, some of the most passionate that I've felt. The way the fans are through the concourse, the way they chant and the emotion. Like, you can just feel how much that fan base loves basketball. And Texas is a football state, a high school football state, a college football state, and an NFL football state. And yet the Mavericks fans, that passion is there for the sport of basketball. And then this happens where it just reverses all of that. And some of the Mavericks fans in my life are like, I don't really want to root for the team anymore. I don't feel like I care as much anymore. And that's just... Like you talk all the time about, like, you know, which fan base is like does it suck to be like the Bulls stuck in the middle, the Sixers, you know, just completely drained, all these injuries and feeling like there's no hope and feeling like the error is over and you're starting the process again. But the Mavericks are very different in that, like, it's like you just pulled out everything you cared about, everything.
Yeah.
For the last 20 and years, the NBA, with Dirk and then Luka, it's just gone.
Yeah, and the NBA, you can root for the individual a lot easier than it is in other sports. And so I think a lot of Mavs fans are probably looking at the Lakers right now, and as heretical as it sounds, it seems like heresy to say that, like, Mavs fans are now Lakers fans because they're backing their guy, Luka. But that is much easier to do in the NBA when there's national TV games, when one player can really draw you in ways that, like, I don't think I'm rooting for the Dodgers because Mookie Betts went to the Dodgers. Like, I'm not doing that. I'm going to stick by my Red Sox in that same scenario where it's like, I can't believe we lost Mookie Betts. I'm not going to go root for the Dodgers in the same way. I think basketball is different. And the thing is, like, there was a quote that Patrick Dumont had in that 9-minute sermon there that I think should have gotten a poll quote, should have gone viral, is that he denied the whole conspiracy theory about the Vegas move. He said, the idea of moving to Vegas makes no sense to me. Completely opposite. No, the team is never moving to Las Vegas. We bought the Dallas Mavericks. It's going to stay the Dallas Mavericks. What's interesting about that quote is I kind of feel like Mavs fans are like, ah, damn. You know, like I'm kind of bummed now. Like the Mavs fans, they've been so beaten down and it's been so downtrodden as a Mavs fan. I kind of think they were hoping that maybe the Mavs would move with Patrick Dumont and the Adelson family, that they would go to Vegas so that they could now get a new franchise in Dallas in the same way that Seattle is now getting a new franchise after they got gutted and moved to Oklahoma City. And I kind of feel like him saying we're not moving to Vegas is it's gotten so bad that I think some Mavs fans are secretly hoping that they would go to Vegas so they could get a new ownership in place.
Yeah, just forget about basketball for 15, 20 years. And then when the new franchise comes, there you go, new owners. Well, I do think there are certain Mavericks fans that would want that. I don't think the team's going to move for what it's worth, but I buy that they're not going to move. I think you're just going to have a new franchise in Vegas, a new franchise in Seattle, and that's going to be that. It's just basketball will never be the same in Dallas, at least for another generation. It won't be the same. And that's what's a bummer, man, because it's going to take a generation for them to turn this around. When you have old AD, who very well could get traded this offseason, and you definitely won't get back the return that you should have gotten for Luka, and Kyrie out until next season. Like, it's going to be a disaster for Dallas. It really is. I feel bad for them. Let's talk about the Warriors, a happy story. They're 12-1 with Jimmy Butler in the lineup. Jonathan Kuminga made his return on Thursday, had a big game. Kuminga looked great. Everything feels like it's slotting in place together for the Warriors right now with Jimmy Butler. It's amazing how one player can be added and everything just starts to feel like it makes sense. The one thing I will say, though, Tom, they haven't faced anybody. They haven't really faced anybody yet. Their best wins so far are probably against the Knicks without Kat, Kings on the road after the All-Star break, the last game before the All-Star break against the Rockets. They haven't had a tough schedule, but the real tests are coming. They face the Knicks on Saturday, again, though, no Brunson. On Monday, they face the Nuggets. And then on Tuesday, they face the Bucks. To me, this stretch is really where we're going to get the best barometer test for what this Warriors team is. Because so far, it's been an easy schedule. With that said, I don't want to diminish it, though, because Jimmy Butler looks great. Stephen Curry is playing unbelievable basketball, though even though he got 4,000 three-pointers on Thursday, I think that back issue was bothering him on Thursday. But their depth looks great. Quentin Post in the starting lineup. Jonathan Kuminga looks great off the bench. Their depth is better than a lot of people, I think, give it credit for. So that's where I'm very optimistic about the Warriors. But I still want to see them do this against the best teams in the NBA. And their schedule just hasn't had those games up there yet for them.
Top tier title contender. I'm saying it.
Top
every
tier?
Every Monday.
Top tier?
I'm putting them as a five. Five-star title contender with Boston, OKC, and Cleveland. I've got four teams
You're not waiting for those Denver and Milwaukee games next week. You're not waiting for them. You're putting them top tier.
Nope. I'm putting them top tier. It's not just that they're winning these games.
What if they lose? What if they lose both of those? What if they lose both of them?
Sure, but what if they win?
I should have kept them at four. What if they win? Then it clearly is.
I mean, if they lose, yeah, I can reevaluate. But if they win, then I look smart by putting them on the top tier. The thing is with them, that's with everything. I mean, you don't want to get too entrenched in your opinions that you won't react to new information. If they lose both of those games, okay. But I do think that they could win those games, and you're seeing the Minnesota Timberwolves wax the Denver Nuggets, and in ways that similarly, those two wins against the Nuggets recently are their only like two big wins, and the rest of the winning streak there with Julius Randle is like, okay, you're beating up on Charlotte, you're beating up on some backwash teams in the standings. Okay, but they can only play their schedule. And the same thing with the Warriors is it's not just that they're facing a soft schedule. It's that they're winning so convincingly. They don't seem to have a hole on the roster. And when you put them on the top tier, I'm saying I don't see many holes on this roster. I can see holes on the Denver Nuggets. I can see holes on the Minnesota Timberwolves, the Lakers. I can't really say that about the depth that they're showing and what Jimmy Butler brings as a stable, a guy who, as Dan Devine mentioned, he's like a metronome. He is very consistent. He brings some stability to the team. And since They were acquired Jimmy Butler. They're number one in free throw differential. And before the trade, they were 27th. They're now number one in turnover differential. And before, they were not number one in turnover differential. I can promise you that. And so this team is playing such smart, high IQ basketball. And in a playoff series with all the that roster healthy, I think they're in the top tier. And you know what? I gave it to the listeners. I've got the Tom's title tiers coming out on Monday, but you already got a sneak peek. I'm making a change for the first time in months. The top tier five-star title contenders is now four teams, not just three.
We'll see. I need to see him next week. I want to see that Nuggets and Bucks back-to-back. And then again, after that, they're going to win a hell of a lot of games. Their schedule eases up again. And then in early April, they have a run of games. April 1st, Memphis, then the Lakers, then the Nuggets, then the Rockets, and then the Suns. Who knows what the Suns look like at that point? They might already be in Cancun. Who knows? Maybe they'll be fighting for their lives to get the 10 seed at that point. But there's two more stretches for Golden State this year that I think are really going to show who they are, whether they're like top of the top tier, like even, you know, a favorite, or whether they're just in that second tier. But I think it's bold to put them at number one. I respect it, Tom, because they've been playing awesome basketball. As I said, it's not just Jimmy Butler. It's not just Butler. It's the way all those pieces are fitting right now and how deep they look and how many different guys that are playing well. I mean, Pods is out right now, for that matter, or has missed some games. And even without him, they're still playing well because Moses Moody is playing really well in the starting lineup, because Quentin Post is able to start games and play 20, 25 minutes and provide spacing and size as a 7-foot center. Because you bring Jonathan Kuminga back in his first game and he scores 18 points in 20 minutes. Like, Kuminga had some really good stretches prior to his injury a couple months ago. So for Golden State,
and don't forget, GP2 had a career high the other night against the Blazers. Yes. So, like, he's playing well too in ways that we were missing last year. We want to see guys like GP2 play as a five when they're like 6'2". It's really fun to see guys like that contributing to winning teams. And I think, you know, when you mentioned top tier, I'll just say, I'm not saying they're the number one team in the NBA, that if I was power ranking the league, I'm not putting the Warriors at number one. I'm just saying, in the terms of the top tier of title contenders, I have them on the same tier as Cleveland, Boston, OKC. And they would be the fourth team on that list. I would still pick OKC in a series, but man, this team was playing. Yeah, Jimmy Butler is adult diapers. It has been decided. If you want to understand what that reference is, go listen to The Big Number. Dan Devine just came up with nicknames for Jimmy Buckets, and we landed on that one. I would say for the Warriors, Kev, what is it that you want to see against Denver and Milwaukee, that not just winning that game, but is there something that you want to see that you're not totally sure whether they can play up to that ability against those two teams?
I just want to see it. I want to see it against some of these top tier teams. A team in Denver that I believe, despite some of their recent hiccups, has a chance in a postseason setting. I want to see how they defend that team. I mean, we'll talk about Minnesota in a second, but they came with a very clear game plan against the Nuggets to expose them on both ends of the floor. I want to see what they do against Giannis. And granted, the Milwaukee is an Eastern Conference team. You wouldn't be facing them into the finals, and I don't think the Bucks will make the finals. But just seeing them do it and replicate the success, how do these role players perform in some of these games? All of this combined was just going to increase my confidence in Golden State. Granted, it's not going to change a lot in terms of what we've seen so far against some of these lesser opponents, because they've looked unbelievable. All the pieces are fitting together. A lot of evidence is already there. It's just seeing against a higher level of competition would just increase my confidence in order to move them up into that type of tier that you're going to be doing on your Tom's title tiers on Tom the Finder over on Substack on your Monday post. Let's talk about that Minnesota team, because they have won 11 games in a row that Julius Randle has played. They're 6-0 with him in the lineup since he returned. They beat the Nuggets again, five straight wins against the Nuggets earlier this week. And once again, man, like, it is crazy how much Minnesota seems to have figured out Denver and what they did defensively in that game against the Nuggets offense, leaving certain guys open, Westbrook on some possessions, Pickett on others, Najee on others, creating a wall around the rim. I know Jokic scored over 30 points, but I thought from a game plan perspective in terms of filtering where they want Jokic to pass the ball, it was magnificent. Again, with all their length and versatility, they come out and execute their game plan at such a high level defensively.
They did. Rudy Gobert quietly is a top three defender on Jokic. When you look at the numbers, it's Zubats and Gobert are two of the primary defenders that can actually not just manage Jokic, but also the team defensive rating is less than 100. When you look at Rudy Gobert guarding Jokic this season, the Nuggets are averaging less than a point per possession in a lot of possessions. And he was the primary defender on Jokic in that last game. This is a formula that can work when the Nuggets do not have Aaron Gordon, when they have to rely on those depth pieces, you know, the bench guys, 9, 10, 11 on their depth chart. That's going to be a problem. And the Denver Nuggets are not the same when they don't have their full complement of players. And that's obvious for every team, but especially with such a thin roster like the Denver Nuggets. The Minnesota Timberwolves are playing with a lot of fire. They're playing with a lot of defensive intensity that we were missing from the first half of the season. And maybe it's just a matter of getting more minutes and reps with Dante DiVincenzo, with Julius Randle. You mentioned 11-0 in Julius Randle games. I'll also point out DDV. This dude is averaging 16-5-5 in his last 12 games, and he's shooting 49% from downtown. He is very much looking like a sixth man of the year candidate. Too late to get that now, but that was the vision with Dante DiVincenzo. And Mike Conley's playing a little bit sharper. This team has got the depth that you don't have with the Denver Nuggets. And yes, depth is less important in the playoffs when the rotations shrink and you're only playing 6, 7, 8 guys, big minutes. But man, Minnesota looks really strong right now. And I will also caveat, if we're going to do this with the Warriors, we have to keep that same energy with the Minnesota Timberwolves. They beat Dallas by 1. They played Denver, of course. They won that one. Atlanta with no Trae Young, no Dyson Daniels. Phoenix, Utah, Phoenix, Philly, Charlotte, Miami, San Antonio, and then Denver. So the schedule has been soft, but they have taken advantage of that soft schedule, and they have won every single one of those games. So hats off to them.
And it continues to be soft. I mean, like their remainder schedule is pretty weak for the rest of the season. Like if you're betting on a team that's going to move up in the standings, obviously Golden State is rolling. They're currently the sixth seed. They very well might be the team that ends up moving up. But Minnesota, only a half game back at the moment, they could as well. They're currently the seventh seed. Warriors are 3 back from the Lakers and the Rockets, 4 back from the Grizzlies and the Nuggets. Just add a half game for Minnesota currently in that seventh spot. These standings could shuffle quite a bit, especially for as long as LeBron is out for the Lakers. He is currently day-to-day along with some other Lakers starters. We'll see, man. But Minnesota and Golden State have very, very easy schedules for the remainder of the season, with Minnesota having an even easier schedule, I would argue. So for the Wolves, I think you're right. You got to keep the same energy with them there. With that said, I do think this, with the games on the schedule, like I said with Golden State, their pieces have looked great. Everything seems to fit. With Minnesota, it's the same thing right now. Everything seems to fit. And friend of the show, Dane Moore, made a post recently where he's like, I see how Julius Randle made all NBA teams, because the way Randle's playing right now, he's leading the Wolves in assists this month. They're putting the ball in his hands. He's facilitating. He's making good decisions. He's playing harder on defense. It's like, this is the best version of Julius Randle again. We're seeing that version of Randle. It's so funny. I can't think of another guy in the NBA where I go from just hating to watch him more than anybody to loving to watch him, but in the back of my mind thinking, when is he going to turn back into the Randle that I hate? It's just so crazy, the disparity in these versions of Julius Randle.
He is probably up there, top 5 most polarizing player in the league. And when you look at the last 5 games, he has more assists in the last 5 games than he's had in any 5-game stretch since 2021. So that's been five years since he was on this kind of run, this heater, in terms of distributing and playmaking. And that's what you want to see from Julius Randle, right? It's not dribbling the air out of the ball time and time again. It's setting up your teammates, making smart plays. And, you know, the three-point shot is something that is kind of the swing skill for him, is when the shot's falling like it was against Denver, it's tough to beat the Timberwolves. And again, DDV, I'm not going to say the Timberwolves won that trade, but the way that the team has been playing as of late and the way that the New York Knicks have been kind of hitting a wall as of late, I do think that this is as close as it's ever been in terms of the results of that trade, the Cat trade this offseason, where they got the pick, they got Dante DiVincenzo and Julius Randle. And at first I thought that was a heist for the New York Knicks, getting Karl Anthony Towns. And the way the slow start for Minnesota and DDV and Julius Randle, I was kind of like, man, highway robbery. But the way that they've been playing recently, I don't think you can argue that it's been a clear winner either way on that trade. And that's something that I would not have foreseen earlier this season.
No, especially with Randle playing the way he is now. And DiVincenzo has significantly improved since his slow start of the year. And I mean, look, dude, like, not all teams click right away. It's just the reality of it. And you're trading a fixture of your starting lineup and Karl Anthony Towns, who helped define he was a big piece in figuring out who Minnesota was last season defensively, with him sliding to the four, effectively playing that way next to Rudy Gobert, offensively with his spacing and his connective passing ability, the downhill attacking. It takes a lot of time sometimes for certain teams to figure out how to be a new way, especially with guys like Randle. And so for Minnesota, the way they're playing right now, again, easier schedule recently, but the way they've been playing, it's encouraging for their chances to be one of those teams that could upset in the first round. I mean, who knows, Tom? Like, currently, the way it is, Warriors 6th seed, Timberwolves 7th seed, Clippers 8th seed, with James Harden on a run. He had 50 points recently. He's been playing some of his best basketball of the entire season. 31 points per game in his last five games, 10.2 assists for James Harden. 6, 7, 8. I'm not picking all three of those teams to upset 1, 2, 3 Thunder, Grizzlies, Nuggets. But there's a chance with those teams that they at least have some deep series. So I'd think we'd at least get one or two potential upsets.
Man, this playoffs is going to be so awesome. Like, oh, yeah. God. If we get Kawhi and James Harden.
The West is going to be awesome. The West.
Yeah. 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 If you look at the 6, 7, 8 in the West versus the East, it's a huge difference.
Oh, boy.
But, you know, no disrespect to Detroit and Indiana, and, you know, it drops off from there, but that is Atlanta, an incredible race. Yeah. It's an incredible race. When you look at it, Kev, for that sixth spot, it is one of the great, you know, inventions of the play-in tournament, is the fact that, like, there's now a race for that sixth seed that you didn't have earlier to avoid the play-in. Minnesota, the Clippers, and Golden State. It's going to be awesome to watch. And then we get the postseason. So I cannot wait. This is going to be a great stretch of games here the rest of the season.
This is why incentives matter. There's incentives to tank, because even though the odds have been flattened, there's still a higher percent chance when you have top three, top four odds than there are when you have the 10th bets odds. There's incentive to tank out of the play-in to get higher draft odds to make sure you don't accidentally get into the playoffs. There's incentive to get the 7 or the 8 seed instead of the 9 or 10, because you need to win only one play-in game instead of two play-in games as the 9 or 10 seed. There's incentive to get the 6 because you're automatically guaranteed a playoff spot. There's incentive to get a top 4 seed because you're guaranteed home court in the first round. Where I wish there were incentive, and this is something I've been beating the drum of for years, is I still wish the top 4 seeds were allowed to choose their first round opponent, because as currently constructed with the NBA standings, Tom, yes, the OKC 1 seed, you get home court through the Western Conference playoffs. Congratulations. Oops, guess what? You get the Golden State Warriors in the first round, or you get the Minnesota Timberwolves in the first round. Like, really? Like, that's who we get for winning 67 games and we're the 1 seed? I think there should be incentive for the Thunder to get the first pick of their opponent. Currently, the Grizzlies as the second pick, the Nuggets as the third pick, and then the four seed, currently the Lakers, would get the leftover team of the bottom four. But then there would be incentive to be the two seed instead of the four seed, or the three seed instead of the four seed. Currently, you're going to have teams, inevitably, as these standings start to kind of shake out by mid, late April, where teams are going to say, oh, we're going to try to lose this game because we'd rather be the three seed instead of the two seed. I don't think there should ever be incentive to lose for these playoff teams. It should always be about winning. And the way to do that is by allowing teams to choose their first round playoff opponent. And that's how you spark rivalries too.
110%. Could not agree more. And there's another reason why this is so important as an invention or an addition in this era of the NBA. Injuries are happening more frequently. And let's say something happens to a top player on Memphis or Houston or the Warriors, it changes the calculus dramatically. And so for these teams like OKC, I think they should have the ability to choose their opponent based on the current set of injury situation. And when you have a team that has a huge injury to one of their top players, which happens more frequently now than it did 20 years ago, this is a different era where star players are playing 70% of their games rather than 90% of their games. This is when the player availability will matter more. And these top teams should be able to say, you know what? I want to play that team that is shorthanded, even though they're number two in the standings. It's going to be a much easier thing than that team that just got Jimmy Butler and Steph Curry.
I think that's complicated, Tom. Like, you can't allow the one seed Thunder to choose the Grizzlies as a two seed. You can't allow that. Like, I think there needs to be incentive for the two seed as well, like to fight for the two seed. It can't be just the Thunder get to choose their team. I think the top three seeds, that's the order. Like, I think that's too extreme personally, where if the Thunder could choose the two seed, I think that's too much. I think it needs to be the two seed and the three seed also get to choose as well. So, like,
fair.
Currently you have Memphis, Nuggets, Lakers, Rockets, all one game separated from each other. And then the Warriors and Timberwolves, as I mentioned earlier, four games back and four and a half games back, respectively. There should be reason for the Rockets to be fighting like hell to get the two seed rather than, you know, end of the year, maybe you rest a guy. It should matter more that LeBron's out for the Lakers, where it's like, damn, like we're going to get the two seed and we're going to get our choice of our opponent in the first round. Whereas if you're the four seed or even the five, it's like, dude, the team that best matches up against us could choose us in the first round. And that's where, like, everybody talks about, how do you make the regular season matter more? You make it matter more by adding that other incentive, by making it matter more in terms of what your playoff standings are going to be, instead of just random as currently is. Long story short, Tom, 1, 2, 3. It'd be fun. It'd be drama. You'd get a draft with these teams selecting their first round opponent. There'd be rivalries that brew. It'd be awesome. It'd be great drama. I would hope it happens someday, though. There's no indication that it is. We're just dreaming here about how to make the season better and make this final stretch even better than it will be, because it's going to be great as is.
Tired, all-star draft, wired, postseason draft. That's what we want.
Please.
That's what we want.
Make it happen. Make it happen, Adam Silver. Please make it happen, Adam Silver. Tom, appreciate you joining me today, man.
Hey, thanks for having me. Always pumped and jacked to be on the show, man. Congrats on 50.
Appreciate it, man. We got Gordon Hayward coming up next, talking about Duke, Cooper Flagg, Duke prospects. Who's going to step up? That's coming up next. Joining me now is Gordon Hayward, who's working with Colgate. Gordon, how you doing today, man?
Good. Thanks for having me on, Kev.
Appreciate it. So the big news on Thursday is a Cooper Flagg injury happened. He played 15 minutes for Duke, turned his left ankle, helped off the floor, was wheeled off for x-rays. And fortunately, he was back on the bench in the second half, walking under his own power, did not have a walking boot on. Scary situation, though, for Duke, though, Gordon, to see him go down. And I would expect with an ankle sprain of that severity, he'll probably miss the remaining of the conference tournament for Duke and maybe even the first round of the NCAA tournament. What's your initial reaction to the Cooper Flagg injury?
Yeah, it's tough to watch anybody go through an injury like that, especially ankle injuries. That's obviously something that I had a little ankle injury of my own. It's not fun to deal with. You know, it's when something like that happens, it's really scary because, you know, when you can't put weight on your foot or anything, you don't know how it's going to turn out. Hopefully hopefully he'll be okay. I think for Duke, it's not a one person has to step up and try to, you know, fill his shoes. His shoes are too big for that. He does so much for that team. I think it's going to have to be everyone steps up a little bit here, a little bit there, to try to replace some of his production. I mean, that's what's been so impressive to me about him being so young and his motor. And it's not like he can just score. He does a little bit of everything. And more than anything, he helps them win. Which is something that's really, I think, hard for young people to do, is lead teams to victory and not just stats. But you know, hopefully he'll be back for the tournament. But, you know, if he's not, it's going to have to be everybody step up as a cast.
You mentioned you know all about those, obviously. You went through it to the worst degree. And hopefully for Cooper, he's able to get back this month, play for Duke in the NCAA tournament. We'll see if he's able to do that. But ultimately, though, however long he's out, you're right, this is going to have to be a by-committee thing for Duke in order to continue advancing to a point when Cooper Flagg is able to return and maybe even be able to be effective. So I'm interested in seeing how other guys step up here. Konkanipple, number one, really, in my eyes, from the guy who can help himself from an NBA draft perspective and also is going to be as important for Duke in terms of advancing. He had 28 points, 7-14 from the floor, 12-13 from the line. He had also had 8 assists and 1 turnover in this game without Cooper Flagg. 3 lobs to Malawach, ran a season-high 14 pick and rolls in the game, according to Synergy. Konkanipple looked excellent without Flagg out there eating up a lot of touches. I thought he was tremendous in the game.
Yeah, I mean, so when somebody goes down, there are opportunities for other players. That's just the reality of how it works. There's only one basketball, and when Cooper's in the game, he's going to have the ball in his hands, especially in crunch time and when the game's on the line. So certainly gives Con a chance to show his stuff. And if he can produce like he did today, I think he'll really definitely up his stock, and the Duke Blue Devils will be really happy if he can do that.
Is it lazy to compare Konkanipple to Gordon Hayward?
It might be a little lazy because two white guys. For me personally, I was always only compared to white players, and I always felt like that was a terrible comparison because I was more of a scorer, not a shooter, but because I was white, everyone wants to say, oh, he's a shooter. And so they compared me to other white shooters in the NBA, but I was way more of a slasher, especially the beginning of my career. I think I was only like 30-some% from three at Butler. So it could be a little bit of a lazy comparison, but he's a great player. I'm looking forward to seeing what he does in his future.
For what it's worth, my Konkanipple comparisons that are going to be coming out in my draft guide, Cam Johnson and Bojan Bogdanović. We'll see, though, because the pick and roll, that's where, you know, Cooper Flagg eats up so many touches in so many different areas. They just ran pick and roll over and over and over again with him and Malawach, hit him for 3 lobs. And Malawach is really that second guy who I think is going to be able to hopefully benefit for Duke this year. Towering rim protector, 7-footer, 8 points per game in about 20 minutes per game this season, shooting 68% from the field. Without Flagg on defense, there's going to be even more on the plate of Malawach. How would you describe his game and his importance to Duke and what he could be in the NBA?
Yeah, extremely important to be able to have a guy to protect the rim. I mean, you can funnel your whole defense. You can funnel them right to a guy like that. And if he can protect the rim, it changes your defense. I played with somebody in Utah who was obviously really good at protecting the rim, and Rudy Gobert. And when he was on the court, it allows you on the perimeter to feel like you can be up in people's shorts a little bit more. You can take a couple more chances because, you know, if you get beat, you're sending them right there to Rudy. And so if he can be somewhat similar where he's big, long, vertical at the rim, not bailing guys out, making things difficult, you know, your defense just jumps to a whole nother level.
Now, I've always been, you know, in sports media, like a Rudy Gobert guy. Like, there's been a lot of like skeptics of his game in the playoffs. I think Gobert is a sensational talent. in the playoffs, obviously, everything changes in the NBA. Sometimes he's been pulled out to the perimeter. His offensive limitations have been exposed at times. With Malawach in college basketball, do you see the way, obviously the three-point shot is incredibly important in college as it is in the NBA. Do you think there's similar challenges for some of those interior bigs in college basketball as there are in the NBA that Malawach and guys like that will have to face?
Yeah, I mean, I think the nature of the game, there's a lot of the skill's never been higher. Shooting's never been better. Guys are shooting it further out. And so if you start doing this thing where we're going to switch and we're going to start finding where's Waldo, find the Mickey, find the matchup that we want and go at him. If that starts being the case, then, you know, he's going to have to prove I can guard people on the perimeter or at least force them into tough shots. Me personally, I'm okay with giving up, you know, contested step back jumpers as long as they're only getting one shot with my big out there on the perimeter, if we can still get the rebound. But that's something that teams are going to have to figure out. Guys like him are going to have to figure out if you're out there and you're getting blown by and now they're getting wide open layups or wide open corner threes or kickout threes. Now that's a real problem. And I think sometimes that was some of the criticism with Rudy is they're just spreading the court on him and, you know, he's not able to defend five out type of stuff. But certainly it's something that teams and players like that got to keep an eye on.
Isn't it ultimately, though? I mean, like in the case of Rudy, defense is about five guys. Like, it's like not like it could all blame could be on one any individual player ever.
No doubt. There's definitely a truth to that. And that's why we're expecting him to be at the rim when we get beat. You know, you're saying if it's a one-on-one game, it's a completely different game. That being said, the thing I think about step back shots and when guys switch and now all of a sudden it's like the world is watching you versus whoever you're switched onto. And it's a loud bucket. It's a really loud bucket. It's not. So if somebody hits a step back shot, it's like, oh, Rudy can't guard him. And for me, I hate that. I think, like I said, I'm fine giving up contested jump shots. It's kind of a defensive philosophy thing. And to your point, it's 5-on-5. We're not going to it's not just 1-on-1. It's not Rudy versus whoever. So sometimes you got to make an adjustment and funnel guys. Okay, I know that, you know, he's a little bit quicker than me. I might get beat, but I'm only going to get beat baseline or I'm only going to get beat middle because that's where my help's at. And so that's a coaching thing. That's a philosophy thing.
I mean, so for Duke, Malawach, Con Knipple, Isaiah Evans, Tyrese Proctor, their guard, spark plug off the bench. Isaiah Evans had 14 points in their game on Thursday. Proctor, not a great game as a starter, but he's been a lot better this season. So we'll see. We don't have news yet on how long Flagg will be out, but they're going to need a team effort in order to continue advancing. St. John's advanced to the semifinal in the Big East tournament. They beat your Butler Bulldogs. I'm sorry, Gordon. It's probably the worst thing that happened to you today.
They did. But if they're going to get beat by somebody, St. John's looks really tough. So now you can start to root for St. John's a little bit.
With RJ Lewis, he 20 points, 7 boards in the day. Do you see NBA potential in him?
Yeah, you know, I was at the game today at MSG, and it was – I looked up, and all of a sudden he had like 16 points, and it was a very quiet, easy 16 points. He didn't force anything. He kind of let the game come to him. He had some tough buckets, but a lot of it was just, like I said, letting the game come to him, and that's – I can appreciate that in a player, not just trying to press and force for buckets or force for points. And so he's got size. He can shoot. He can defend. All of those guys can defend. And I think if you have those qualities, then certainly NBA GMs are taking a look at you.
All right. I want to talk about three Big East prospects with you for people to watch this month, starting with Friday, Cam Jones of Marquette facing off against St. John's. Cam Jones came back to school this year after Tyler Kolek went to the NBA last year, got drafted by the Knicks. A lot more pick and roll for Cam Jones this season. His 3-point percentage dropped. What's your overall assessment of Cam Jones's game, and how do you see him translating to the next level?
Yeah, I liked him today. I got a chance to watch a little bit of Marquette versus Xavier. It seems like he was more of a distributor role this year with Kolek gone. I think last year probably more off the ball, but he if he can get to the rim and really set up his outside jump shot by being able to get to the rim, that's when I think he takes another step and goes to another level. Being able to be a dual threat guy and not just focusing on either thing. Either if it's only I can only get to the rim or I can only shoot threes, being able to do a little bit of both is really what makes you so dangerous. And then I like that this year he was able to pass the rock too and get other guys open. And so definitely liked what I saw from him today watching.
I mean, ultimately, even though his three-point shot was not nearly as good this season, I still feel like he helped himself from a draft stock perspective, because the playmaking was the big thing. Like, he showed little flashes last year in the games. Kolek missed a stretch of games, and Cam Jones looked pretty good as a distributor in those games. But being able to do it for a full season, he looks more like he could be like a DiVincenzo type rather than just like basic spot up shooter, that type of guy. So I'd say he helped himself this season. So that, like,
for
it's,
sure.
It's beneficial to go back to school for some of these guys.
Yeah, no doubt. And this goes back to what we were just talking about earlier. Sometimes there's only one basketball on the court. And if you have somebody that's really good, and like Kolek was at running the show, it didn't give him a chance, Cam Jones, a chance to show what he can do from a playmaking perspective. So, Shaka must have leaned on him more this year and said, hey, I'm going to need you to distribute a little bit more and get other guys open. And so showing that he can do that certainly helps your stock.
For sure. And let's talk about another upperclassman in his fifth year, actually, Ryan Kalkbrenner from Creighton, 7'1", 270 pounds. We're recording this before Creighton's Thursday night game, but entering it, Kalkbrenner has scored 25, 23, 20, and 27 points in his last four games, averaging 19.4 in the season. Came back for his fifth season and looks like borderline first round pick. How would you describe Kalkbrenner's game, Gordon?
He's a problem, certainly there in the post. He can pass it a little bit too. You want to talk about talking about Rudy Gobert. I think I saw something. He won Defensive Player of the Year four years in a row in the Big East. Is that correct?
I believe so.
That is a crazy stat. So talking about grabbing up rebounds, protecting the rim, he can do that. And that's rarefied air. I think Ewing? Was he the only other one that did that?
It's crazy.
That's rarefied air. So, and with his ability with the touch that he has, if he's putting up numbers like 20 balls like that, seven games in a row, certainly Creighton is a dangerous team heading into this postseason here. I don't think you would want to see them with him and Ashworth, both guys that have been around and have done it and have experience. So, they're going to be a tough out for sure.
Yeah, I mean, Kalkbrenner, like, defensively, no doubts about him. 7'5 wingspan, great shot blocker, smart defender and all that. I'm intrigued by some of these bigs. Like, this year in the NBA, Quentin Post from Boston College going in the second round to the Warriors has been one of the steals of the draft. Like, this archetype of seven-footers who show some touch from three, and also a bit of feel, and can at least provide size around the rim. Like, I think Kalkbrenner is one of those types of guys where, even though he's around 30% from three, he's got solid touch near the rim. He's 70-ish percent from the free throw line. Like, just bringing these guys into your system, like, every team needs bigs. And whether it's Quentin Post last year, who, a lot of people didn't even know about, or Kalkbrenner this year, who's in his fifth year and is kind of a bigger name going into the tournament, these guys are important in the NBA nowadays. Like, size does matter.
Well, size when you can guard the rim matters 1,000%. I think that's what NBA teams are looking for. And also they're looking for size that can spread the court. I mean, I've always said, to me, one of the most valuable players on Milwaukee's team was Brook Lopez. Certainly on the defensive end, Giannis got all the accolades, and there's no doubt Giannis is the one that made him go. But Brook is the one that just anchored their entire defense and was unreal. He's still good now, but for a period of time there, he was one of the best bigs, if not the best big, at being around the rim and spreading it out on the perimeter, giving everybody so much space on the offensive end. So if Kalkbrenner can have, if he's that type of an archetype and mold where he can spread it to three and he's protecting the rim, that's someone you want on your team.
I mean, even Zach Edey started shooting threes this year. He barely shot at all for Purdue last year.
And I haven't seen that. Yeah.
It's crazy. I mean, he's shooting like one or two per game. It's not like a high volume, at least having that as a tool. Isn't it crazy though how, you know, you mentioned Brook Lopez, he's this low post beast for the Brooklyn Nets for years, and then he becomes a good 3-point shooter.
All-star for them, right?
All-star, yes. And then Al Horford, yeah, who you played with. Horford, an interior guy for years of the Hawks who could hit a mid-range jumper. And now he could play till he's 40 if he wants to, in part because he put in the time to develop the 3-point shot. And like all these bigs coming up now, I feel like so many of them try to shoot threes. Some of them show the ability, others don't. But it is a necessity almost at this point for bigs to at least show the potential of that.
No doubt. But what I think young bigs have to understand, though, is first and foremost, you got to be able to protect the rim. That's I think the thing that will get you on the court. And both those guys, you know, Edie, Brook Lopez, they're monsters around the rim. I mean, you're not getting an easy bucket around the rim.
Last guy I want to ask you about is Liam McNeely, freshman at UConn, 6'7", 210, averaging 14.7 points per game on 34.7% from three. What is your assessment of McNeely's game, Gordon?
Well, we've got this whole white American shooter comparison again to go on.
He's probably a better comp to you than Con Knipple is, I think.
Right. Well, I wish I would have had a chance to see him play over at MSG, see him live. I haven't caught him live. I've just seen some highlights. But what's impressive to me, he's a freshman too. Is that right?
Yes.
What's impressive to me is, after going over to MSG and watching some of these college games, we talked about Kalk Brenner. I mean, this is a fifth and sixth year seniors here that these kids as a freshman are playing against, and they look like they've been eating weights in the weight room for the last 4 years. I mean, they're huge. They're way bigger than some of the young cats that I was playing with towards the end of my NBA career. And so it's tough out there. You think you're driving to the hole and these guys chest you up. I mean, if you're a freshman, you have to be really good to be doing it to these guys in this league. And so that's what's impressive about McNeely. Somebody like McNeely is his ability to play against some of these guys that are, you know, 5-6 years older than him and have been in these college systems for a while. So it certainly is impressive to me.
So Gordon, clearly you decorate your home with mouthwash and toothpaste from Colgate with what's behind you right now. What's the deal with this with Colgate?
Yeah, so I had a chance to partner with them for the Big East tournament, which I'm really thankful about, getting a chance to go and watch my dogs play, but also talking about some oral health and oral hygiene. One of the big things I'm telling people is to be dentist ready. And nobody wants to go to the dentist stressing about whether or not you have cavities or not. And so Colgate Total has released this new program. There's a mouthwash, toothpaste, toothbrush, you know, and if you use all three, it's going to help prevent, I think it's like 15 times more preventative for oral health problems if you use this system every day. And that speaks to me because I've got kids. It's a nightmare to try to get these kids to try and brush their teeth in the morning and at night. But it's like a monkey see, monkey do. If I'm doing it, I'm using the system, then they'll stand next to me and they'll get the job done too. So it's been fun getting a chance to watch the games, talk to people about, you know, their oral health. I'm glad I'm here.
I've never had a cavity. Huh. Have you?
Seriously?
No, never. Not a big candy guy.
See, no, I think that's almost like a genetic thing. You just got really good genes.
It might be. I'm not a big candy guy though either. Have you had cavities?
My thing is I drink so many of those sports drinks, and I think those are terrible for your teeth. Oh, yeah. They tell you all that citric acid. That's what I'm blaming it on. If I would have had this prevention system back then, I wouldn't have had those cavities, let me tell you.
Got to use Colgate mouthwash, the dental floss, and everything else. Gordon, appreciate you joining me today.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks again to Tom Haberstrom and Gordon Hayward for joining me on today's episode of The Kevin O'Connor Show. Thanks to Father John Misty for providing the music. Thanks to Mike and Emmy for producing it. And thanks to you for giving us a listen. It really does help out if you give us a 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. We just hit 700 ratings on Spotify. We're nearly at 300 on Apple. Let's go get 800 on Spotify. Let's go get 400 on Apple. It really would help out if you give us that 5-star rating. Hope you have a good rest of your weekend, and we will be back later next week.